Policy Heads.
We're back
after a long while. I hope everyone is staying safe and staying home. So we've been away for so long and we want to apologize for it, but we've been staying home and we've been trying to curate a series of special episodes on COVID-19 and how it impacts different sectors and different point of views.
Yeah, I've got to say, like, this is a very weird time because it's phenomenal for us to look at it at a policy aspect of, like, the changes and in terms of, like, the welfare system, how the government have just been implementing different whole new policies that we didn't think that they would ever do before, that their health system's under crisis, and how this is just affecting everyone around the world is actually quite phenomenal. As tragic as it is, it's been mind-boggling for us, I would have to say.
And I guess also, you know, the situation in the 21st century with digitalization and how fast-paced the society can be, the way in which governments around the world are reacting to COVID-19 are absolutely, I won't say revolutionary, but it's different.
Yeah, well, as you were just saying, like, each country is kind of implemented its own way of going about these whole things. Like, we've got in Australia, we've got the lockdowns in the numerous states, the shutdown and borders. So, like,
the US,
the US being what the US is, whatever that's, whatever you call that. I've got to say, like, I've really been following the American way of handling the crisis day to day. It's actually quite phenomenal on the differences we can see between different government systems and how they react to this crisis.
But also the governments that we generally think or generally assume that they would have similar types of, you know, political climate, similar institutional systems, they react very differently one to another, which is really crazy and very unpredictable to see, like, countries in Southeast Asia as well, how they handle things very, 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 very differently.
Yeah, and it's weird for us as university students right now because we're kind of, and also as myself as a worker, a casual worker, especially in Australia, where everything's fast changing in terms of my education. Like, you and I are both now doing our assignments online, we're doing our classes online, and how we're losing that actual interaction with our lecturers and our teachers and also fellow classmates. And that's probably not going to be as bad for us as it would be for, like, teaching students or medical students or students who require that face-to-face, that real interaction. And also for us as workers who work on our casual rates, like, how we're going to sustain ourselves as long as these lockdowns and these crises occur. So I think that's going to be a phenomenal thing to do and to research as time goes on. But it's, in a nutshell, that's probably why we've been a little bit up in the air, because the way that we look at the world in terms of policies is rapidly changing, and the way that we live our lives.
Yeah, so this point going forward, and we expect this to be 2 months of us posting special episodes on COVID-19, especially how the political climate is being impacted and how it impacts the government's policies on acting upon COVID-19 as well, but also how it impacts the healthcare, the people and who are most affected by COVID-19. Also, we are very keen on talking about how it would impact the global economy and political aspects globally as well. It will be very interesting to look at different points of views in terms of how the governments and public policies are handling COVID-19.
For our first episode is basically surrounding the political economy and the global economy. And for that, I actually had an interview with Professor Andrew Walter, who is a professor at the University of Melbourne. He is a professor of international relations in the School of Social and Political Sciences. He holds a master's in research in international relations and a doctorate in international relations from Oxford University, where he also previously held academic positions. He's actually published numerous articles on the political economy of international money and finance and their governance among and within countries. Furthermore, he's also really recently released a book called The Wealth Effect. I think that was very good to have an interview with him. So as you all probably may or may not know, that because in Victoria we are now in stage 3 lockdown, it means that we can no longer really go outside without having an essential reason to do so. And due to that, we are not able to get into our pod room. And so due to that fact, we will probably be doing most of our podcasts and podcast interviews with special guests from our homes and remotely. So sometimes you may see a little bit of a change in audio quality. Unfortunately, we have to kind of work with what we've got, but we will kind of deal with that as time goes along, because right now it's such a fluid situation that we need to kind of take it step by step. So what this episode is truly about is I interview Andrew about the importance of the financial systems and how governments react with monetary policy to COVID-19, and also how the governments themselves, in terms of like the political spectrum, are reacting to COVID-19 as well. And I think that's a very important aspect we all touch on at the moment, because other than there being a health crisis on the back burner of this, we've also got a financial crisis, the likes that we haven't seen since the global financial crisis only over a decade ago. And Andrew's extensive research into past crises will give us more of an aspect and a perspective of what the government does and why the government does it, who also works with the government to stave off these financial recessions, and how those actually impact the relationship between voters and the government, and also the government and the rest of the world economy. And a lot of people are frightened right now about economics, because economics is such a big, broad area which some people don't actually understand. And so when they hear recession, they think, what's going to go on? Am I going to have a job? We normally see a rise in unemployment. But I think it's very important to understand, other than the health side, what the economic and the monetary side of this will be. Thank you so much for coming on the program. I really, really appreciate taking your time out. So I've just got a couple of questions to kind of talk about the state of the world at the moment, because we've kind of moved into this unforeseen aspect of health crises and impacting the economies around the world. So I just wanted to get your expert opinion on a number of these factors, on how it shapes political systems, how it shapes financial systems. So my first main question to you, as a person who's studied financial crises and the impacts and the fallouts and how policy response by institutions comes about, what's your current view and what's your current outlook on the world economy, fiscal responses, monetary responses, and political institution responses as a whole?
Well, the first thing, just to say quickly, you said unforeseen, and I think, I mean, in a sense, that's true. No one clearly saw this coming as of about November last year, but we did see it begin in China at the end of last year, and some countries, including the United States, were receiving information that perhaps they should have acted on much earlier than they actually did in practice. And we see this in the UK and some other prominent cases as well. So we saw this coming, and governments delayed their responses in some cases, at least in retrospect, in rather catastrophic ways. The other thing is that many people have been warning for some time that a pandemic was coming, and it was only a matter of when. So the precise timing may be unforeseen, but this is a crisis that was entirely predictable. Prominent people like Bill Gates have been talking about that recently, but many others. We see governments, in terms of their preparation and the policy responses that they've been forced into subsequently because of the lack of preparation. Governments like the UK, for example, running the NHS on about 95% capacity over the past decade, in part due to fiscal austerity. And in retrospect, again, that's pretty catastrophic. The NHS was designed to be on about 85% capacity to allow for pandemic surges or seasonal flu surges and so on of an unexpected kind. So So we need, before we answer the question about, you know, the kinds of policy responses that governments are adopting in response to, in inverted commas, an unforeseen exogenous shock, we need to take into account the fact that some governments ought to have been far better prepared than others. We'll probably come on to later, for example, in terms of economic policy preparedness. For example, again, the United States was running an extremely large fiscal deficit before the crisis hit, at a period during which essentially the economy is running at full employment. Again, another sense in which governments should not have been starting from this point in the first place. In terms of the Australian economy, levels of household indebtedness are at historic highs, and that may in turn be driving the way in which the Australian government is responding, because it's so damn scared of the consequences of an economy running into a wall and households essentially not paying mortgages and so on because they're being laid off. So when we're thinking about policy responses, we need to think about where governments were when the crisis began, whether they were sufficiently well prepared in health policy terms, in fiscal and monetary policy terms, because clearly in many cases we ought to have been in a different position. But of course we're not, and we are where we are, where we are, as they say. And governments are responding in quite unprecedented ways. One important distinction, I think, and particularly given that people will be, you know, as they are searching at the moment for historical analogies, people have compared this to the GFC about 12 years ago. People have compared it to World War I or World War II. And there are many ways in which these analogies are helpful, but also in some cases potentially misleading and unhelpful. I think specifically compared to a big financial crisis like 2007-09, though that of course dragged on for many years. In cases like Italy, we were still seeing bank bailouts as of 2017. So the GFC in many ways was something that a number of countries hadn't yet recovered from. So that's another factor. But the big distinction, I think, between this crisis and the GFC was that the GFC was what we would call an endogenously driven financial shock. That is, large amounts of debt or leverage were built up in financial systems, to the point where the financial system itself became deeply unstable and dragged the rest of the economy down when it began to fall to pieces in big economies like the United States, the United Kingdom, and the rest of Europe in 2007 and 2008. This is in distinction from that kind of endogenous, financially driven shock. This is an exogenous shock to the global economy. So it comes from the outside of the economy, even if, as I said earlier, it should not have been entirely unpredicted or unforeseen for any serious policymaker out there. So an exogenous shock to the system that has not this time occurred within the core of the financial network in the economy. The financial system has actually been made much more robust by some of the reforms introduced since the GFC from about 2009 onwards. So this time the financial system isn't at the core of the crisis. Nevertheless, we are seeing collapses in economic output of a kind that actually look much more like the Great Depression. And again, in distinction to World War I and World War II, when typically output was ramped up by governments as economies were placed on a war footing, we're seeing collapses in economic output. On average, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris, the OECD, estimates about 2% GDP declines, real GDP declines per month as lockdowns pursue. So we've just seen figures for the French economy come out. The French economy fell in real terms by about 6% in the first quarter, so from January through March. That's quite a catastrophic collapse, and it's on the lines of the Great Depression. So we are in a serious, serious global economic crisis. The seriousness of that crisis is underlined by the kinds of policy responses that governments are adopting around the world. We can get into some of the details, I guess, later, but about 16% of GDP equivalent, unprecedented for an Australian economy, which was seen as relatively robust, even if it wasn't quite, before all this hit. And we haven't seen any serious financial problems yet. That may be further down the track, depending on just how long this persists. But as yet, in other words, we're seeing an economic shock driven by a pandemic that is, in real terms, larger than what occurred during the GFC, and for which really there's no precedent, perhaps outside of the Great Depression in the early 1930s.
In comparison to other leaders who have come before in these certain major events, like we had the incoming Obama administration, we had the incoming Labor government during the GFC, how do you believe that the leaders of the world at the moment are responding to the coming crisis economically and in the health crisis?
Well, I mean, in varied ways. So the International Monetary Fund, for example, is now tracking the different fiscal and monetary and unconventional measures that are being adopted by various governments around the world. The United States, so the fiscal stimulus in the United States, or the fiscal package, broadly conceived in the United States, adopted, what, a bit more than a week or so ago. Even a week seems a very long time ago now, not least in US politics. So a bit over $2 trillion US dollars, in real terms, about double the size of the fiscal package that the new Obama administration pushed through Congress in early 2009. So getting on to 10% of US GDP, unprecedented, not least perhaps given the extreme levels of political polarization in the US Congress that have, if anything, worsened since President Trump began his presidency in early 2017. So, you know, some kudos, I guess, to the US Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, and colleagues negotiating with Congress. I don't think President Trump himself played any significant role. Probably that was a good thing in that particular negotiation. But we see, in other words, fiscal measures in the United States, and when combined with some pretty massive and extensive interventions, even by comparison with the extraordinary interventions that the US Federal Reserve, the central bank, undertook from 2007 onwards, quantitative easing and all of the non-traditional lending facilities that the Federal Reserve set up during that period, we're seeing some extraordinary interventions now by the Federal Reserve. So in addition to those fiscal measures from the US government, we're seeing the Federal Reserve setting up facilities to lend directly and indirectly to big corporates. It's now talking about facilities for small businesses and so on. It's been intervening in so-called asset-backed securities markets to prop them up, because some mortgage markets, for example, have been faltering quite dramatically in recent weeks. Even the US Treasury market, the deepest and most liquid and largest financial market in the world, was very shaky a few weeks ago. Foreign central banks and governments were seeking to liquidate some Treasury debt, and a number of people were, or a number of financial actors and economic actors in the system, were seeking cash in what was quickly becoming an economic emergency. So the Federal Reserve had to intervene effectively by promising to buy as much debt, US government debt, at various different levels of the US federal system, but particularly federal government debt, as well as corporate debt, just to shore up the financial system. So I think this time around, we should remember that the global financial crisis began in about August 2007 in the United States, and it really took until the beginning of October in 2008, so more than a year afterwards, for the US Congress to pass its first rescue package, the so-called TARP package, in early October 2008. So more than a year delay in getting its act together. This time around, the US Congress has acted pretty quickly, and the Federal Reserve in particular, under Jay Powell, has acted extremely quickly to set up a number of and copy a number of the facilities that were adopted during the GFC, but also to go well beyond that. So that has helped to stabilize the financial system. This time, interestingly, again, in comparison to the GFC, the US banking system looks, at least so far, relatively solid, and the US government is seeking to use the US banking system, as indeed other governments elsewhere are doing, to push cash out into the economy, and particularly the $350 billion that's been allocated as part of that large fiscal package in the United States, pushing money out through the banking system into small and medium enterprises to shore up that very, very fragile part of the US economy with many, many small companies, as here in Australia, simply shutting their doors and closing down. And these companies would be collapsing because they just don't have the deep pockets and the ability to borrow from capital markets that big companies do. So that's been a really important part of the measures. We're seeing some real problems there in getting the money out the door quickly. And US banks have not been able to move as quickly as some of the optimists in the Treasury and Congress hoped. So that will be interesting to watch. But we are seeing some pretty extraordinary measures. And of course, the United States has, it set the pace in many ways, but countries like Germany have also been doing some really big and quite extraordinary things by German historical standards, at least in the post-war period. So these countries which are taking the lead are also, of course, shaping the way that governments respond elsewhere. And I think, you know, it's interesting to think about how what we call policy spillover or diffusion from other countries shapes the politics and policy elsewhere. So we see it makes it more difficult, for example, when governments like Germany and elsewhere in Europe adopt wage subsidy policies for workers that are essentially, stood down or furloughed. Makes it difficult for governments in places like Australia to avoid doing the same because they start to look, unresponsive and cheap and unreasonable and potentially destructive of economic growth. So we see policies, spilling out through the global economy as some of the leading economies adopt these kinds of measures.
You've touched on central banks quite a bit and the Federal Reserve. Just for some listeners who may not really understand what central banks are or where they sit in terms of in monetary policy or determining monetary policy, what's their regular role in the Australian economy when there's not a crisis, and what are they kind of doing now to kind of help stimulate the economy in Australia, Europe, America and Britain?
Yeah, well, the traditional sort of boring textbook description of central banks, particularly after the so-called monetary policy consensus emerged after the 1970s, the traditional role of central banks in a standard economic textbook would have been for central banks to target a range of inflation. Let's say about 2%, and to try to hit to keep the economy moving, growing in a range that would not push inflation either too far above that target or too far below it, and they would typically do so by keeping it simple, manipulating the level of short-term interest rates so that if inflation is moving well above the inflation target of about 2%, central banks would typically be raising their short-term interest rates to push down on inflation. And if inflation is falling below that target or expected to do so, we would expect central banks to be reducing their target interest rates, which set the floor to interest rates in the rest of the economy. Now, that textbook model of central banking is essentially being thrown out the window and has been really since the GFC began in 2007. That being said, of course, central banks are slashing interest rates, and essentially interest rates set by central banks these days, so the base lending rate in countries' financial systems is now close to zero. So essentially they've cut interest rates to very close to zero. But that's, of course, not the only thing or indeed the main thing they're doing. And this is where quantitative easing and all of these other sort of unconventional, or what used to be unconventional but are now becoming rapidly very conventional measures are being undertaken. So central banks are buying government debt. Indeed, they have been in massive amounts in North America and Europe since the GFC began in 2007 and 2008. So even fairly conservative-minded central banks, so very anti-inflationary central banks like the European Central Bank in particular, with a very Germanic ethos, an inflation killer bank modelled on the German Bundesbank, which it replaced along with all of the other independent central banks of Europe that joined the Eurozone in the common monetary area. So the European Central Bank has announced recently a €750 billion facility to purchase essentially debt, and that includes the debt of governments as well as corporations. So when in financially stressful situations, economically stressful situations such as that which we're in now, when the price of debt, that is the price of bonds issued by governments, so governments raise debt by issuing bonds and selling bonds to investors, and those investors could be insurance companies, pension funds, banks, and many others in the economy, the cost of raising debt is going up. That is, you know, would you buy debt issued currently by an airline?
Nope.
Would you buy debt currently issued by a government in distress, such as Italy? Well, maybe not. So investors are going to, they're not, you know, the cost of issuing debt, that is the interest rate, is essentially going up dramatically because the threat of default or the threat of losses on the debt that's issued is clearly going up. So what central banks are doing, in other words, is intervening to stabilize the cost. So they're acting as buyers of last resort, in a sense. So they're purchasing government as well as corporate debt, big corporates issuing debt in the market. So they're buying that debt in order to stabilize the price and to keep interest rates from escalating well above the base interest rates that are being set in the financial system by central banks through their more traditional monetary policy means. So in other words, governments may be able to borrow at close to zero. So, you know, the cost of government debt in the United States and in most of Western Europe is very, very close to zero, at least at the short term. So they can borrow very cheaply, but a distressed corporation, such as an airline or Boeing, which is in serious trouble, of course, too, the cost of their debt, the cost at which, you know, they can issue debt into the market and the sort of interest rate that the market will demand is of course, going up. So fiscal measures that provide direct assistance to the likes of Boeing or to airlines, which is included in the US fiscal package, will help to convince investors that these companies are not going to go bankrupt, and therefore push the interest rates at which they could borrow through the roof. But in addition, action by the central bank, this unconventional monetary policy action to invest effectively and to create a market in the debt to be a purchaser of last resort, will also push down on the cost at which these companies and entities can borrow in the market. So in the absence of this, we just may see, you know, a rush to the exits, and people would be selling not only the stock of, so let's say, Boeing Corporation or American Airlines or other big corporations that are in severe distress at the moment. Not only would they be selling the stock, that is the equity capital, they'd be selling debt as well. And this could rapidly push these companies towards bankruptcy without these radical fiscal and monetary measures. Mm-hmm. So central banks, in other words, are doing all sorts of crazy stuff that literally 10 years ago wasn't in the textbooks. And this is true not only in the United States, it's true not only in the Eurozone, it's true in the UK, it's true increasingly in Australia. So if anyone wants to go and look at what the Reserve Bank of Australia is doing, it's right up there on the website, and they are engaging in all of this sort of unconventional quantitative easing as well. And what that essentially means is taking the debt of other actors, including the government and the private sector, onto their own balance sheet. So the central banks are becoming the proud owners of lots of debt issued by other entities in the economy.
So we've had over the past couple of months, and maybe over the last year, this there's been an idea thrown out by some economists and analysts that say that after the GFC, that central banks have kind of run out of ammunition, and that's why they were engaging in this quantitative easing. And there's also been economists analysing that, as you mentioned before, the Australian economy was quote-unquote robust, but it wasn't technically safe, and that the Reserve Bank of Australia was pushing the government to introduce new fiscal stimulus to basically get the economy to grow a little bit more than it has. Do you believe that because central banks had run out of ammunition, that they have had to go to the government and say, we can't do anything else except quantitative easing?
Yeah. So, yeah, when economists talk about central banks running out of ammunition, essentially what they mean is that interest rates were, that is, again, the base rates that central banks largely control, the rates at which they essentially lend reserves to the financial system, were already quite low. So when we're talking about slashing interest rates in this crisis, I'm now forgetting what interest rates, the central bank interest rates were exactly sitting a few months ago, but we're talking about reductions of, you know, 1% or so in many cases. So they were already quite low, and that's a legacy of the GFC itself. So the world economy was not in a robust situation in which outside of the United States, which was growing quite strongly, much of the rest of the world economy was relatively soft. And that's true in Australia. So although Australia was, as is often said in newspapers, hasn't had a recession for 30 years, and of course real wages have been increasing at least over the longer term, they've been pretty soft since 2015 or even earlier. So the Australian economy has been doing less well than a number of people claim. Unemployment was edging up. So it was already around, a bit above 5% before the crisis hit, this latest crisis. So, and parts of the Australian economy, particularly Western Australia and other parts of the more commodity-driven parts of the Australian economy, were also pretty soft. So So it's not true to say that the Australian economy was robust, and it's certainly not true to say that much of Western Europe was either particularly strong. Britain was clearly heading for a partly Brexit-induced recession, quite likely before this crisis hit, and many central banks, therefore, had already been keeping interest rates quite low. And the Reserve Bank, as you said, in the case of Australia, was asking for more fiscal stimulus. Now, the Australian government has undergone a kind of Damascene conversion ideologically. It was unwilling to deliver what the Reserve Bank wished in terms of fiscal stimulus. So there wasn't a lot of room for the Reserve Bank of Australia to cut interest rates more, given where the Australian economy was. And so it was natural to expect that the government would need to undertake fiscal stimulus in order to maintain something approximating full employment. Now, the Australian government, or at least the coalition government, for some years has maintained that a core objective has been returning to fiscal, some kind of fiscal surplus, and therefore it has been ideologically unwilling to, before the crisis hit, take that route and to respond in the way that the Reserve Bank wanted. Now, the crisis came along, and all of a sudden they're spending, more than 10% of GDP on, pretty much everything they can think of, copying programs elsewhere, adapting them to the particular circumstances of the Australian economy, boosting unemployment benefits in ways that politically, 3 months ago would have been unthinkable. The Australian government, over the past couple of decades, is one that in comparative terms is pretty stingy on unemployment benefits, for example. So levels of unemployment benefit in the United States, in Australia, are far below the OECD average. This was a policy that was only therefore sustainable during boom times. Essentially, it was, well, here's, if you're unemployed, here's a bit of money. If you're young, go home and live with your parents. If you're not, if you can't do that, well, here's a bit of money to tide you over, but basically go out and get a job. And we're going to means test the hell out of you. The Australian government system has also been one of the most means test intensive, and therefore from the perspective of many recipients, one of the meanest systems around, particularly compared to, historically Scandinavian countries, where essentially, there's very little means testing of unemployment benefits and other forms of social transfer. So the Australian government, in other words, has shifted from being at the very stingy end of advanced countries in terms of unemployment benefits, in terms of its overall fiscal stance, that is, a desire to return to a fiscal surplus even in what was already a fairly soft economy, in fairly short order. That was driven largely by politics and ideology, I think. So this was seen as a sign of fiscal and government competence. That's all been thrown out the window. There's no prospect of any time soon returning to government budget surpluses, I think. So the government has really been forced to junk what was a fairly well-entrenched model of a pretty light kind of welfare state, nothing like Northern Europe, something much closer to the United States. And that creates a couple of difficulties. Just quickly, one is clearly ideological. How do you go, in other words, from saying that, we don't really believe in generous unemployment benefits and social transfers on a kind of European, or at least Northern Western European model. We want to keep the state and taxes relatively low, but again, by average OECD standards. So there's what I would call ideological strain going on here. it's also a problem, of course, for the Labour Party on the left, because now the coalition government is essentially occupying their territory in the crisis. So they've swerved from, ideologically, a kind of neoliberal policy stance to something approximating a kind of classical welfarist policy stance. You know, we're going to subsidize wages, we're going to we'll subsidize companies to keep workers employed, we're going to substantially increase the real value of unemployment benefits, and all of these other measures which ideologically were unthinkable before the crisis. So that's a challenge both for the coalition government, but it's also a challenge for the centre-left in Australian politics, because, you know, what do? Do they go further to the left? The second kind of challenge it presents is what do you do after the crisis abates? Do you roll it back to the old system and say, we're going to go back to a thin, highly means-tested, fairly stingy welfare state? You know, when people may ask after this, well, okay, you started guaranteeing much higher levels of real wages for people in distress during the crisis. Why can't you promise this in normal times? So there's a big question, and no doubt many conservatives in the coalition here in Australia and their equivalents elsewhere are deeply worried by what they would see as the kind of moral hazard implications of entrenching or appearing to entrench a more generous kind of social safety net than they've been willing to contemplate in the past. So we're going to see a big post-crisis when all this eventually abates. Let's hope it does sooner rather than later, but we're going to see a big problem about, you know, what kind of system does the government attempt to reimpose the status quo of the pre-crisis era, or does it ultimately, you know, fundamentally transform the nature of social expectations and the relationship between, well, you know, politics and the centre right and the centre left debate about approximately where the welfare state should sit over time. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult to return to the old status quo, the ex ante status quo.
Sticking on that for a moment, I just wanted to ask you, in your time seeing governments come and go, how do you believe that governments will probably be able to deal with this? I know this is probably going to be a large question to kind of answer, but how do you believe that governments such as the coalition government are going to be able to snap back from these kind of stimulus packages that are guaranteeing wage subsidies? Do you have any possible ideas of what they could do?
Well, you know, I mean, what they will do is they will clearly say that these are extraordinary measures that are unsustainable. They're only being adopted because this is a temporary crisis. Much depends on the evolution of the pandemic itself, of course, and the effectiveness of the public health measures, the lockdowns and so on that have been put in place, and whether when winter sets in Australia, whether pandemic contagion gets worse, whether there's a return to more infections in the Northern Hemisphere as lockdowns start to be taken off. We're seeing Wuhan and other centres already being opened up, at least somewhat. We're seeing places like Germany and Italy talking about removing some of the social, or I think better termed, physical distancing measures. So we'll see, but obviously, so much depends on just how bad and how extended the pandemic itself is. Yeah. So in terms of snapping back, so I think it's going to be difficult for a number of reasons. One is that in many ways, public policy had not really yet substantially adjusted to the emergence of quite a different economy and particularly mode of employment, a lot of self-employment, gig economy workers, and so on. So we're seeing some of these new measures in these crisis packages really reflecting that changed reality. So if you like, public policy, I think, had substantially lagged in terms of its coverage and the ability of social safety nets, whether of a fairly thin kind in places like the United States, the UK, and Australia, or of the fairly extensive kind in places like France, Germany, and Scandinavia. They've all, I think, had difficulty adjusting to the rise of part-time employment, the gig economy, self-employment, and these things. So I think particularly in those kinds of areas, as governments have rolled out and extended the social safety net to encompass some of this, and in some this is a gradual evolutionary process for some countries. So we've seen, for example, in the United States, the $2 trillion fiscal stimulus package extended for the first time unemployment benefits or topped up unemployment benefits, $600 per week benefits to gig economy workers, the self-employed, and so on. We are going to see how effective those measures are in practice in terms of the way in which they're implemented, and that's something maybe we should come back to a little bit. But just to finish the answer to your question, we're also seeing similar extensions of packages to cover gaps in the social safety net as these emergency measures are being rolled out in places like Australia and the UK and so on. So that's all very welcome, and I think it's going to be really difficult for governments to say, to roll it back again to the status quo ex ante, that is where policy was, you know, 3-6 months ago, in not providing substantive coverage to these people, who, after all, at least if you know, they're following the law, these people are paying taxes. Yeah. These people, you know, law-abiding citizens. They just happen to be working in a part of the economy that, after all, has been growing. And thriving, and of course governments in many ways want to promote these new economic sectors and activities. So they're going to have to think hard, I think, about which elements of these packages they retain in the longer term, and they may need to reshape them, of course. But the economy has really, and the labour market has been changing quite dramatically in ways that have not yet been adequately reflected in social safety nets of whatever form. So I think that is... that, it seems likely to me, is going to be a substantive permanent shift. And again, it's going to be difficult, I think, for governments to say, well, you know, back to the, you know, if you're working in the gig economy, and all the risk is on you, buddy. But I think more broadly, my overall view, looking back, you know, not just at this particular crisis, which we're still living through, but through the GFC, and even further back into the various crises in the 80s and 90s that hit a number of economies and the emerging world as well as the advanced and developing worlds. But what we see every time is governments responding in deep crises, financial crises mainly in the 80s, 90s and during the GFC, but now in this non-financial crisis. We see governments responding in ways that go far beyond the rhetoric and the broad policy consensus of neoliberalism that became entrenched in a lot of policy circles, and above all in places like the United States, Australia and the UK, New Zealand, in the 80s and 90s, that governments should get out of the way of markets. They should provide a broad, stable regulatory framework. They should largely avoid large fiscal deficits. Of course, many of them didn't live up to that in practice. And they should stop trying to fine-tune economic growth. When crises hit, governments find that that kind of ideological policy stance is simply unsustainable. And the Australian government is finding, perhaps for the first serious time for the past 30 years, that they too can no longer sustain this pretense that, you know, the state should be small, the taxes should be low, that social safety nets should be thin, and that government should really not do any, you know, serious lending to corporations. Government should get out of the economy. They shouldn't be owning companies, and all of these policy norms that everyone became very used to, and some people still seem to believe, despite all of the evidence, that governments rapidly abandon these policy norms when the going gets tough. So I think beyond what I said about, you know, bringing in the gig economy and self-employed workers and so on into social safety nets, I think broadly speaking, what we're seeing here, you know, after all, it was only 12 years ago when the GFC started, and governments did all sorts of extraordinary things. And it's often forgotten, even in Australia, extraordinary fiscal stimulus, extraordinary guarantees to the financial system to prop it up, and various other measures. And Australia pretends that it really, you know, the GFC never touched it, but it did. Governments abandon these kinds of neoliberal policy norms when bad times hit. And so naturally people will start to ask, voters will start to ask, why can't we have more concrete promises that if the going gets tough, you will do these things in the future? We will have serious problems further down the track. And you know, we see the next big one coming towards us already. And, you know, like the pandemic, which was a known risk, climate change is the next big one coming. Mm. And citizens and voters will quite reasonably ask why governments will not prepare better for the next pandemic or the next climate-related shock or shocks that will almost certainly come down the track. And they will also almost certainly ask governments why governments can't actually put into place more reassuring systems of social insurance that actually live up to the standards that they adopt in emergencies.
Well, I just wanted to touch on one last kind of subject before we wrap up the interview today. We've talked about major economies, economies that have substantial welfare systems, substantial healthcare systems and financial systems and governments. But I just want to take the focus quickly onto developing countries, such as Sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia. What do you believe will be the severe impact on them other than the health crisis? So how do you believe that the economic fallout will affect their social inequality, how their government and political systems operate?
Well, yeah, that's a big question. And the answer almost certainly is, in many cases, it's going to be even more devastating in developing countries by quite a long distance. So we've seen, the crisis began in China, of course, and China is an emerging market economy, so upper middle income now by global standards. A country with pretty substantial state capacity, and particularly the capacity to impose lockdowns of the kind that we saw in Wuhan. Many developing countries, significantly poorer than China, do not have the public health facilities that China has, the state capacity to impose lockdowns. Chinese residents in many large cities are living in pretty dense living environments. The people have questioned the validity of the Chinese statistics. We see Chinese infection rates per million people and so on significantly lower than in much of Western Europe and the United States, and death rates are significantly lower as well. And pretty clearly, early in the crisis, China or the Chinese government was pretty blatantly lying about how bad the crisis was getting there. So we don't yet have all of the full facts on how China has handled this crisis. We will see. Hopefully that information will come out in subsequent months and years. But there's no doubt that China's capacity to manage this crisis is far superior than most emerging and developing countries. We're seeing really different strategies in some other big emerging market countries like Brazil, where the federal government seems under Bolsonaro to have lost the plot and be in complete denial. But their state-level governors have been responding much more effectively, particularly in Rio and Sao Paulo. In much of the poorer parts of Asia, sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America, the crisis yet has, for the most part, to arrive, but almost certainly is likely to spread there. These are countries with healthcare systems, with some exceptions like South Africa and so on, that are far poorer than in places like China, let alone the advanced world, Europe, the United States, Australasia, and so on. And even in Australia's near backyard, I mean, there are clearly cases in the South Pacific countries nearby and Southeast and South Asia and so on, who are going to have a very, very hard time if this virus takes substantial hold there. The IMF is already lending emergency packages to dozens of developing countries. Almost certainly this won't be enough. So these lending packages will help to ameliorate the crisis, but state capacity in these countries, the ability, you know, if you look, if we know that New York doesn't have enough ventilators, or maybe they do, they say they might just have enough now. But if some of the most developed parts of the world, Northern Italy, Lombardy, has a world-class healthcare system, but it was completely overwhelmed. If Lombardy, if New York, if parts of London get overwhelmed, you can imagine how bad it will be in many of these places. And in terms of social physical distancing, we just know that people living in poor environments are in a much, much more challenging environment in terms of their living circumstances, and their ability to distance physically in many places is close to zero, let alone before we start talking about things like refugee camps and so on. Millions of people living in refugee camps on the border with Myanmar and Bangladesh, in parts of the Middle East and Northern Africa. These are time bombs waiting, you know, just unfortunately to get a lot worse. And so the situation there is pretty appalling, but at the moment the crisis is very much focused on the advanced world, and particularly North America and Western Europe. But these are the places that are most able to bear the brunt of the crisis. So let's hope it can be contained to these places that are best able to bear it. We should just say something too about internal inequalities within countries. There is almost certainly no doubt that severe inequalities within places like the United States and the United Kingdom mean that the quality of healthcare services, the starting point at which various communities in poorer parts of the United States or the United Kingdom began this crisis, is far, far worse than in wealthy parts of London or New York, where people often have jobs too that allow them to work remotely from home. But many poorer people, of course, are operating in parts of the economy, again, going back to the gig economy, to parts of the service sector, low-wage jobs in retail, in restaurants, and all these sorts of things. These are the people who are most seriously affected by the crisis. So we get a glimpse of how bad it could get in developing countries, in other words, by looking at the poorer and more disadvantaged parts of our own wealthy societies, where, again, the brunt of this crisis is being felt, and where, going back to the previous question, where much of the social safety nets historically have been pretty poor in terms of dealing with that inequality, but where now promises are being made that are going to be very difficult to roll back after the crisis ameliorates.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Andrew. I really appreciate you coming on today. And I hope you're staying safe and staying well in your house today and for the rest of the coming months.
Will do. You too, Jared. It's a pleasure. Good to talk to you. And good luck with the podcast.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
All right. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. And please tune in to our next episodes. We'll still keep on posting our updates. And yeah, send us any suggestions or comments or anything. Subscribe.
Yeah.
And share our episodes.
All right. Thank you guys so much. Bye.